Okay, we're just coming up on 7:30 right now, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves, and please feel free to do so if you have a comment or question, or mute yourself afterwards. Welcome all. I have pasted into the chat where you can go if you want to join, but we do welcome guests at any time at any of our meetings for the Ottawa PC User Group, so feel free to continue joining as a guest if you are new to us. But if you do want to join, check out our website, and we'll be happy to have you join up. And with that, I think that's all of the intro stuff I need to cover, and so I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, so we have a mixed bag, I think, as usual. I think we're going to have enough time towards the end for our usual discussion time period, the last 10 minutes. So if you have any questions, you want to put them in the chat or be prepared later on to open up your microphone and ask away. We'll see how we do in terms of getting to the last 10. Let's start out with a while ago we were talking about BellArc Advisor, and Steve has a follow-up where sometimes it doesn't necessarily tell you the truth. Steve, do you want to tell us about BellArc Advisor?
Yeah, it came up with some security check. Yeah, that one there, the Microsoft update thing for it. And I investigated what it was. And I had it already updated with Winget. And apparently they don't all use the same knowledge base, even though it's the same update. So it says it's not in there, but it is. So you always have to then, whenever it comes up with something, don't just take it as the de facto of anything. So use it as a reference. If it says it's you're missing this, check it out to see if you actually are. A lot of the times you won't be missing it. It's just like, yeah, it's just like Crap Cleaner as well. Only Crap Cleaner is a lot worse. It comes up with a whole lot of stuff. All it does is just, it scrapes the entire internet, finds whatever number version it can, and if it's a newer number than the one that had, it says, oh, you got a new update. And chances are you don't have a new update. All it is just a different variant for another piece of hardware, not yours. And if you go ahead and let it update it, you make things a lot worse. same thing with BellArc, too. So don't just take whatever it says is in your machine, because it may not be right.
Yeah. But in general, BellArc Advisor is pretty good in terms of documenting what's on the system. So it's a useful program, but I guess you've got to take it with a grain of salt every now and again.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, thanks, Steve. The second follow-up we have is a discussion we had about, or a question that came up about self-publishing. And Linda had indicated she was going to check with a friend who had self-published a book. And we'll get to that in a minute. But it turns out I have a friend too who self-published a book, and so I asked him for his experience, and he wasn't recommending a specific publishing service, but he did note two Facebook groups that might be of interest to would-be authors. One apparently is called Canada Writes, and the other one is Self-Published Authors Canada. And I don't use Facebook, but I guess if you're a Facebook aficionado and you go to those pages, websites, whatever they are, you'll find lots of posts about publishing services. And apparently a lot of the comments say that these are scams, and some no doubt are scams. But my buddy here thinks that some of them just charge quite a bit for what they actually do, and some people think that's too much of a good thing. However, my buddy says he thinks it's just free enterprise at its finest. So the usual buyer beware when you're shopping around for anything on the internet. And he notes that for self-publishing services, there's all kinds of different services, and there's all kinds of different prices, and there's all kinds of different end results, the quality. So it really is a buyer beware. And he recommended that the individual looking to self-publish the children's book should take a look at these two groups, and in particular search for keywords which have got something to do with children's books, and then you should find services that might be of interest, but you'll also find authors who have published children's books. And then his thought there was that you could actually contact the authors, and some of them will be willing to share their experience, so you might get a good takeoff from that type of information. The other thing he recommended was going to book fairs or markets where authors, especially authors of children's books, are there, because they generally have some kind of presentation, and then they'll have a Q&A period, so you can pepper the authors with questions about how they did things, I guess. Basically, he just notes caution whatever you do, and try to learn from others who published, in particular, have published similar material. He seemed to think that was an important aspect of it. My friend is called Neil Cochrane, and he's an ex-federal civil servant. He worked for Immigration Canada, whatever it was called back then, and he's written kind of a memoir, which is a bunch of stories about things that happened when he was a frontline officer handling immigration inquiries and some management stuff that he did and so on and so forth. It's kind of interesting. He writes very well, by the way. It's kind of interesting if you are a civil servant, because he comes from kind of my day when things in my department were very technical and it was really a question of making things happen. And then towards the end of the time, it was more managers were being dropped in who didn't know anything about the technical stuff that we were doing. And Neil's take was pretty much the same. So if you are a civil servant, I highly recommend reading the book. You can either buy it from online, or I think you can also take it out of the Ottawa Public Library. Anyway, that's Neil's take on self-publishing, but Linda's friend has some different take. So, Linda?
Okay, thanks, Alan. Actually, it's my sister that was self-publishing, and she, I don't know if you can see, but she produced 3 books for young adults. Now, it was about 10 years ago, but she had a very positive experience using Amazon. And Amazon self-publishes with Kindle Direct Publishing. And so the authors of the books can publish either ebooks, paperbacks, which is what she did, or hardcovers. And there's no upfront publishing fee, which is nice. So for an ebook, what you do is you price it, and if it's $3 to $10, then whoever buys your book, Amazon pays you a royalty of 70%. And if the book costs more than $10, you get 35%. For print books like these, the royalty is 50% if it's $10 or less than $10, and it's 60% if it's more than $10. And then because it's a hard copy print book, Amazon will deduct the printing costs from the royalty. And she didn't get into that. She didn't give me any specifics about the printing costs, and possibly she might not remember. Next slide. So when I put it into Perplexity to make sure this information was up to date, and then I sent it back to my sister and she confirmed it sounded right, Perplexity basically said a 300-page black and white paperback priced at $14.99 will generally earn more than the same book priced at $8.99. That's because the higher price qualifies for the 60% rate rather than your 50% rate. And then Amazon's printing cost calculator is what gives the exact payout after the page-based aspirin costs is removed. So, but just to let you know, the books that she published were for young adults. So while they have nice covers on the front, photos, and nice artwork and that, there's no pages inside with illustrations or photos. So that might not be different for, I think it was Diane that was asking this. It might not work, might not work for you as the same type of pricing range because, you, I believe, wanted some illustrations within the book. So this is all I have in terms of her experience. But she did say it was very positive and she would use it again.
Okay, thank you, Linda. And Chris has some more information from the user forum.
Yes, so this was posted by Tom, and it's quite lengthy, and it goes into quite a lot of detail, as you can see on the screen, talking about different aspects of self-publishing. So if you are interested in that, I highly recommend you check out the URL, and I'm pasting it into the chat. You do have to be a member of the OPCUG in order to be able to access the member forum. And if you're not a member of the forum, but you're a member of the OPCUG, just send me an email and I can set you up so that you are a member of the forum. And then you'll be able to access it at that URL that you see on the screen. And I did notice that Natalie, thank you, posted some information about the Ottawa Public Library has some information about publishing. And it's run by the Writers Collective of Canada, and they're free. And right now they run programs at Greenboro, Amber Acres, et cetera. So you could check those out if you are interested in self-publishing. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Natalie, and thank you, Linda. Okay, next up we have a couple of YouTube tech pages, I think, videos. One here is suggested by a member, Matt Johansson. He creates videos about application security and cybersecurity in general. And he has both a YouTube channel, which is down the bottom there, and also a newsletter that you can subscribe to. And he did have a podcast for that, ended in 2023, apparently. And our member here said that they've been following this guy for quite a while, and he has good security information. So there's a YouTube channel that you may want to take a look at and consider following. next up, Stu was talking previously about tracking airplanes, and now I guess he's moving on to ships. So Stu, you want to tell us about marine traffic?
Okay. Yeah, I was viewing a YouTube that was talking about some problem with shipping something somewhere in the world. I really can't remember what it was about now. But at a point in the talk, the person said, marine traffic showed me these graphs, and I said, well, wait a second, what is marine traffic? So I made a note and later on did a Google search and found a website. And if you want to track boats, not just saltwater boats, but even anything floating in the fresh waters too, if it's got a satellite transponder, this website is probably tracking it. Hundreds of thousands of boats all around the world. And, wow. You want to see a really congested part of the world, zoom in on the Southeast Asia. Wow, it's just insane. But, you know, there's even a few boats on the Ottawa River that have satellite transponders in them that you can follow around and harass if you choose to. I didn't say that, by the way. Anyway, there's a free version which lets you track five vessels at a time and some basic information. And, you can look at the world a few different ways. I really like the satellite view. It shows you a lot of the terrain around the world. Gives it some nice color. It's got nothing to do with the boats and the oceans, but what the heck, it makes the screen look better. And the paid subscription models, let me see, I've got that. Where'd my mouse go? There it is. Ah, yes. Free gets you tracking for 5 vessels, £10 a month. I assume this is a British site. Gets you fleet tracking for 10 vessels and £100 a month. Lets you track 50 vessels at a time. And there are apps. Is there another slide, Alan, or is that it?
No, that was it. Sorry.
Okay. Well, there are apps for Android and iOS. I guess you'll have to go on their respective app stores and just plug in marine traffic, and you'll find the appropriate thing so you can... And you're out in your boat, and some dumb kid is buzzing you in a speedboat. Maybe he's got a satellite transponder. You can find out who he is. Send a nasty email to his mom. Anyway, that's about it.
Okay, thanks, Stu. Okay, next up we have an application for, it's actually a Windows utility, signature verification. It's called SigVerf, and Jeff Dubois gave me the information for this. So it basically looks at your system and checks whether the system files and the drivers are correctly signed with by digital certificates. So it basically, if something's unsigned or something has been altered, then it should show up and raise a red flag kind of deal. And it will actually write the results to a log file so you can see what's going on. Jeff notes it's basically good as a quick kind of check on integrity, but it's definitely not a full malware scanner. So typically you run it when you're trying to troubleshoot a crash or some driver problems or something that doesn't seem to work quite correctly. And you can run this to see if any of the programs are throwing up log reports, I guess, some kind of problem issue that the thing will find. And if you install, well, it's actually installed as part of Windows. If you run this SigVerf, or whatever it was called, SigVerf, right. So if you run SigVerf, then you get this pop-up window, and you can just choose to run it and see what happens. So hit the start button here, and it will scan the files. And in my case, it told me that all the files have been scanned and they're all correctly signed digitally. There's also an option to look at advanced settings. Not a ton of advanced settings here, but clearly you can turn off the log file if you wish. It looks like it's checked by default. You can either append to the log file or you can overwrite it. Again, overwriting seems to be the default. And the log file name, you can clearly choose that. And then here you've got the option to view the log if you wish to do so. So if you want to view the log, then you get, it's basically a text file. So you can see here that it tells me when it's been generated, what the platform is, and then the various files that it's looked at, the version numbers, and whether it's signed or not, and who signed it, and that kind of stuff. So my system didn't throw up any errors, so I don't know what happens if it finds something that's bad. Maybe it shows it in red or something, I don't really know. Anyway, there's one little utility. I don't know if Jeff has anything to add to that. Just one little utility that will do a digital certificate scan for you. Okay, next up, Chris has one of his famous keyboard shortcuts.
Wow, they've graduated to famous. Okay, so we're up to 18, and this is all about moving Windows. When I talk about Windows, small letter Windows rather than uppercase Windows. So any application window you have open on the screen, moving them around the screen without using your mouse. So the first way is Alt and the space bar will bring up the context menu for the active window, and one of the options on there will be M for move. And so if you hit M, then you can use the arrow keys to move the window around anywhere on the screen, and then press the Enter key to drop it at whatever that current position is. Then we get into the faster ones. If you do Windows and the left or right arrow keys, that'll snap the window to fill either the left or the right half of the screen, and you can just progressively press it, and you don't have to switch back and forth. It'll just switch to it'll keep going in that direction. And then if you do the Win and the Up arrow, it'll maximize the current window. And if you do Windows and the Down arrow, it'll restore the window if it's currently maximized. If it's in the restore mode, where it's just using part of the screen, it'll minimize the window down to the taskbar. And then if you happen to have multiple monitors attached to your computer, Win plus Shift plus the left or the right arrow keys will move the window from the monitor it is currently on to the monitor to the left or to the right. And if you don't happen to have this working for you, check in the settings. If you go to Settings, System, Multitasking, there's a section there for Snap Windows, and you have to make sure that's on. So it's probably on by default, but if none of these keystrokes is working, in particular the Windows and the arrow keys, check out to see whether you have somehow got Snap Windows turned off in Settings. And that's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So everybody take a good notes here, because in the last 10 minutes we're going to have a test. No, not really. A lot of keystrokes to remember, though. I can't remember all those guys. Anyway, all right, next up we had a question about laptop overheating. And basically, Carol was asking if anybody had dealt with a laptop that was overheating. Clearly, you can clean the system, especially around the fans and the outputs and so forth. But she checked on AI, and it also suggested that maybe you needed to change the thermal paste between the CPU and the heat sink. So the question was, has anybody dealt with overheating laptops? And I put the question to Harvey, and Harvey is going to give us the benefit of his wisdom. So Harvey, go ahead.
Alrighty. Okay, now, yes, getting on into the interior of the laptop, if you clean that out and all the dust, it will certainly help reduce that heating. And then there's something, as we mentioned just in the previous slide, about thermal paste. So the area between the heat sink and the CPU, if you took the heat sink off, you'll see the top of the CPU, you can clean those both with alcohol and Q-tips, and then you reapply a quality thermal paste, and that should control the laptop temperature. I had one gaming fella, and the complaint was, my computer shuts off. And what we traced it to was the thermal paste that was there was like dust. And we had to clean it off thoroughly and re-thermal paste it, and everything was fine. Now, the other area, of course, your laptop fan and the vent. You need to get that checked to ensure it's all functioning properly. Not that it's just clean, because we already talked about that. You've already cleaned it. But maybe the fan and the vent are not properly functioning, so you're going to have to get that checked. I'm just suggesting that they take it to Trailing Edge. If you feel okay with that, they do very good work. All right, another slide. Now, these two areas that we're looking at, just a bit of information. France Picard, I was helping her with her uploading of files, backup files, to the Google Drive. And her laptop really overheated significantly. And we traced it down, and there's certain settings that you can tweak that will work with the server, the Google server, and your laptop to keep things cooler. So there's these two areas just that I thought would be good to check. And the processor state, and that's part of the Windows options. And there is a thing there where you can cap it to a certain percentage. And that will disable these, what we call these boost clocks. And that will bring down the temperatures under load. Similarly, we have the power modes, and we can look at that and set it appropriately, and that too will help manage the heat. We go to the next slide. This is the sequence of events that you can use to readjust the processor mode. So if you're going to have a look at that and go through this checklist here, and that will help you reset that mode. And the final slide, similarly for power mode, you can go through these steps, and that will allow you to set the power mode. And that's about it.
No, you've got another slide yet.
I do? Oh, my goodness.
You do, yes.
All right. We have, if you wish to also elevate the rear of your laptop, bring it up an inch or so, and that'll help increase the airflow into the bottom. You can also buy what they call those pads for filling the laptop. We have little fans in the bottom. And you also have to verify the fan operation. Now, if you were to take it into the shop, they will check that out for you. But sometimes you can hear a whining sound or a grinding sound, and that's definitely the bearing that's in the fan that's shot. So that will not give you the proper cooling. And then inside the laptop, if you took an inside view, you'd see these copper pipes. And they're called heat sink heat pipes. Now in there is a little bit of liquid. Now if that breaks or leaks, then you will lose the properties of keeping things cool. And in general, now I had one client, the daughter had a brand new laptop, and I found out through her mother that she thought she would just leave it on her bed and use it sitting there. And of course, air cannot get into it if it's sitting on a soft surface. Also, it's a fire hazard. So do be very, very careful with that. Otherwise, you could be in for a rude shock. So always use a hard surface. Now, as I say, you can use those cooling type fans you can buy, where you sit your laptop on top of it. That's a good idea to keep things cool and safe.
Yeah, there's another addition to that. What you need to do is to get a small wireframe stand to put that cooler on top of, so it has area to get the air underneath it to come through. Otherwise, if you're just sitting it on the desk, it can't draw enough air to put it through.
That's in place of raising the back up an inch or so. Yep, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I've noticed this. There's a few laptops that have the intake right in the same place as the output of the heat as well, so it ends up drawing in its own exhaust, which is pretty stupid.
Correct.
Asus does that.
Yeah.
Asus is
worst. Now, do you have a suggestion for a hard surface? You use a baking cooling rack.
That's a good idea.
And Carol has a question in the chat. When researching options for dealing with overheating of an old HP laptop, some said to not vacuum, but to use compressed air. Any additional thoughts or experience with that?
All right. This is just a personal thing about using compressed air. People don't know how to use it properly. They end up spraying all kinds of liquid into their laptop. It's very critical that you keep the can perfectly upright, and then you can spray it. I have a proper computer vacuum so I can use all the attachments for that. But you're on the right path, Carol. You can do that. But be careful. Keep the can upright. Otherwise, you'll have a mess.
And use a toothbrush.
Pardon?
You can also use a toothbrush.
You can, yeah.
Yeah, a toothbrush and a dust dirt devil, the handheld ones work well.
Then there you go.
You can use
toothpaste. No toothpaste.
No.
Yeah, it does kind of make a mess if you do, but
yeah.
Carol is noting that if you have a graphics processor, a GPU, in the laptop, then you might want to consider double duty on the frequency of cleaning, he says.
Yeah, you make sure you take it out carefully, though, to make sure that's cleaned properly.
Another thing you can do, too, that wasn't mentioned yet, is just take the case off the bottom of the laptop and then put that on the cooler fans. And I've done that with mine, and it makes a difference of about 12 degrees.
Yeah. One other thing I was going to mention, Alan, there's a utility, it's called HW Info, and it can actually allow you to put a little red square down in your sys tray, and it'll show what the temperature is.
Okay. Stuart notes, if you're going to replace the thermal paste yourself, note that it doesn't have to be thick, but it does have to be applied over the entire surface of the CPU.
No, it doesn't. You put on a certain amount right in the middle.
That's right, yeah.
When you put the parts back together, it will then spread it properly.
Yeah, he's right.
If I could comment, that's true. Strictly speaking, if you're experienced and know how much paste you need to cover the entire component by spreading it out through compression. But if you're someone who's doing this for the first time, you're better off to put a little extra on to make sure you get that complete coverage, because it's very easy to not put enough on and not know it. You can always clean up the mess later. It's not a big deal.
Well, if you haven't put enough on, you'll know it soon enough.
Yeah, but you'll just have to do it again.
If you get the chance and it doesn't burn out completely.
There's many videos, Stuart, show you how to do that properly. And
I used to work for a company that made circuit boards for harsh environments like tanks and fighter jets and the International Space Station. We use thermal paste on most of these boards.
That's good.
And the problem was the commercial products I saw tended to not have enough thermal paste. That's why it needs to be replaced more often. Whereas by making sure we put lots on, I don't mean lots so that it's oozing out from the chip, just enough that it covers the entire thing, these boards would then last 20, 25 years, no problem. So...
It's like a car. You have a certain schedule, maintenance schedule. You can do the same with your computer. I mean, you can take it apart every 2 years, make sure the paste is still good, or clean it up again, you know?
I'm far too lazy to do that.
No, you're not. Come
on. Oh, yes, I am.
I'm expecting you to come down to see the Olive Garden, have supper. You know, it's only a 4-hour drive.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Harley, and everyone for the discussion there.
All right.
Thank you all. Very helpful.
So next up, I have a share. I call it pre-cutting edge computing. It's an article from Physics World, which is a British journal, Institute of Physics. And it's basically a description of current research in the area of high-level computation. So if you want to know what's going to happen in the future, maybe, it's a very technical article, but there's lots of interesting information there in terms of what may be coming down the, what literally may be coming down the technical pipe for the future. It's a really short article, and doesn't take very long to read, but it is pretty technical. Anyway, that's cutting edge and cutting edge plus in computing technology. Okay, the next thing I have is a question that came in about how do I back up my Android phone? And the answer to this question really depends what you want to back up. And you can use various kind of system tools. Google Account has a process for synchronizing contacts and device settings, for example. You can use Google Photos to back up your digital photos and videos, basically to the cloud. And then some individual manufacturers have, like Samsung, have a smart switch utility, and there's one there from Huawei, that will help you do various things. I guess my question is, what about the actual data files which I produce? Because for me, those are the most important things that I want to back up. I can't get them from anywhere else. And for this particular aspect, I'm suggesting a manual method. Now, there are all kinds of ways of doing this too, so we'll come back to that later on. But the first thing I would note is that from the user perspective, the Android file system basically locks various folders and the included files, and they're just not accessible to you. So you can't back them up just by copying them, because you can't read them in the first place. You can install special software, the TeamWin Recovery Project, TWRP, but you need to unlock the bootloader if your bootloader is locked by default. You need to unlock that in order to make backups using TWRP. And that's if you want to install a custom ROM and overwrite your existing Android system, which has run out of updates, and you want a custom ROM that will let you run older hardware for longer, then you might want to take a look at that, because you will need to unlock the bootloader, and then it's a good opportunity to make the system backup. However, for most people, what we're really talking about is our user files that we created, we stored them somewhere, and what we need to do is back them up onto some different media. The trouble is, the files can be all over the place. The various folders on the internal storage, and if you have a micro SD card plugged into the phone, that gives you a second drive, essentially, and you'll have some of the same folders and files all over the place there. So you basically got to use a file manager to find out what's going on. And personally, I like this CX File Explorer to take a look, because by default, it gives me the option to look at the main storage, which is the internal memory, and also what's on my micro SD card. And when I open up one of those guys, then, as I say, you get lots of different files and folders. And if you start off here, you can see that this alarms folder has zero items. So a whole bunch of these things, if you look down the list here, I don't use a whole bunch of these folders, so I don't need to back them up, because there's nothing in them. And if you look at Android, the Android folder has four, I think these are all subfolders. And the problem is, if you try to open one, you may get this message pop up that says access is denied. This is one of these locked Android system folders that the Android won't let you get into. And some of the other ones have got long names which look like they're actually reverse URLs. And they're pretty meaningless, because they're not yours and you don't know what's really in them. However, things like DCAM, if you look at that one, that is where your photos are stored on the internal storage. And so if we open up the DCAM folder, you'll see there's a whole bunch of other subfolders. One is called camera, so clearly that's the photographs which I've taken with the digital camera on the cell phone, and it's got 34 pictures in there, and some of the others don't have anything right now. And then I've got this oddball right here, this the Tux logo file, and I'm just using that as a placeholder so that when CX File Explorer shows me the folder, I can see that there's something in it, and it gives me a clue that these are photographs. The actual photographs are, if I open up the camera folder, you can see here's all the different photographs, and they've got these wonderful names, and they're all, in my case, they're all JPEG images. So these are photographs I've taken. These are probably photos I would like to back up, just in case I want to copy them and store them as archive material, or just back them up temporarily so I don't lose anything. And here's a folder under the music, a subfolder under the music folder. It's called Merlin. And they're all WAV files, so these are audio recordings. And Merlin is the Cornell University bird identification application. It's basically a field guide to the birds. And one of the options is a sound ID feature. So you can use the microphone of the phone to listen for bird songs, and then the app will actually identify the bird that's singing. And sometimes I will save the files, and sometimes Merlin saves the files automatically. I don't really use these on an ongoing basis, so I wouldn't be interested in backing these up, so I don't have to include that in my backup. And to save space, I could actually delete those files. All right, so once I've identified the various folders and files that I want to save, what I really want to do is transfer them to my computer. So to do that, one of the ways to do that is to just plug in a USB cable. And my charger has a USB cable which can be detached from the charger. So it has a micro USB-C connector at one end and a regular USB-A connector at the other end. So I can connect the phone to the PC. And when I do that, I get this pop-up message on the phone here, which says, do you want to allow access to the data on the phone? Typically on my phone at least, and all Android phones and all Android versions, they all seem to do things differently, so your mileage may vary. But on my phone, when I plug the cable in, the default is that the cable is for charging the phone. So what I have to do here is change the setting so that it will allow data transfer in addition to the charging operation. So all I have to do here is click on Allow, and then I can actually copy files. Now, one of the questions that came up on this was specifically for a Samsung Galaxy A36 running Android 16. So I asked Perplexity, on this phone, where is this setting that allows you to select transferring the files? I know it's under the default USB configuration. And what it tells me is that this setting lives inside developer options. It's a hidden menu, which the member who asked the question, and I personally think this is crazy. I mean, this is a pretty useful setting. Why would you hide it in a menu under developer options, which you have to enable by basically magic? You have to go to system and about phone. You have to tap on develop. You have to tap on the build number 7 times, and then that enables default USB. That enables the developer options, and then inside that you can now find the menu.
If I can interrupt there.
Well, I'm going to just have a second, Chris. So here's what happens when I look at developer options. I've got this default USB configuration option. I can select that, and now I can choose all the various thingamajigs here. Now, one of the things you can do if you can't find the developer options, one of the things you can do is just search in settings for USB, and you'll find it there. And Chris has another technique, which I think he's going to tell us about right now.
Well, no, actually, what I was going to say on that is I would never change the default to be transfer files, because you charge your phone an awful lot more often than you transfer files. And so I would always leave the default option as being to charge the phone. But what I have found on in terms of when it does get plugged in, there's always a way that you can change on the fly to, for this instance, change it to transfer files. And it should come up as a pop-up, but if it doesn't, then normally what you can do is pull down from the top of the screen and you'll get notifications that have gone on that you haven't dismissed yet. And so there will probably be a notification there that allows you to, on the fly, change it for this instance to being transfer files rather than charging.
Just a note on charging phone only. That only applies if you plug the phone into the PC. I don't do that. I typically charge my phone with the charger.
Oh gotcha. True. Yeah.
So actually, when I change it to transferring files, it actually remembers that. So if I plug the phone into the PC, it remembers I want to transfer files, and it doesn't ask me again. But the phone still charges off the charger, which is what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Why you sometimes have to worry if you're out and about and you come across a phone charger that they offer where you can plug in your phone to charge something. If you have it set for transferring files, you're putting it at risk that free current is going to actually take away some of your files, or at least copy them. So just beware. You should always have it on charging phone only as a default.
Just a quick comment. So that was me with the headache, and I did it several times with my PC, and the default was always charging only on my phone. So I couldn't change the default.
Well, that's what Alan was saying. You have to go into the developer options to change the default.
Right. But, I mean, I didn't want to. I just needed to know how to get to transferring it. So, yeah.
But you did do it by searching for the setting.
Yeah. So when I went into the main settings with the little gear icon, there's a search box at the bottom. So I just put in USB settings, and it came up with an answer, and I tapped on that, and it brought me to that right menu. But I couldn't get there otherwise.
And then, if I understand correctly, what you're saying is the next time you boot up your phone, it reverts back to a defaulted charging phone only.
Yeah, and I have to go through the same process. Yeah.
And when you plug it in, you don't get a notification allowing you to change it on the fly?
Yeah, the problem was that pop-up lasted 2 seconds, and I couldn't tap it quickly enough to get there through that.
Yeah,
so your option of bringing down all the notifications, it was there. So even though it disappeared from the screen, it was still in that list. So that was
a
great tip, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the fastest way. If you don't catch the notification when it pops up, is just drag down from the top. So you'll get notifications, and it should be there. Yeah.
Yeah, but the fact, you know, like Alan said, the fact that you have to do all of this instead of being able to get to that menu is just ridiculous.
I spent quite a long time going through the menu trying to find it. It ain't there.
Why is there a MIDI connection on a phone?
Well, you could connect it to a MIDI device, I guess. Why not?
Why would you want to? That's what I mean.
I don't know. I don't have a MIDI device, so I've got no idea. Okay, carrying on here. So once you get the thing set so it will transfer files, basically you can just open File Explorer, and you'll see that Alan's A32, which is my Samsung phone, shows up as basically a device. So now I can open up the internal storage, the pictures, and the screenshots. Here's all my screenshots. And then I can just copy them across. And the way I do that is I open a second window in File Explorer. And here I've created a Android backup folder on my data drive. I've mirrored the pictures and screenshots folder. And now I'm just going to drag these guys over, drop them down here. And bingo, now on my data drive, I've now got all the screenshots backed up, right? Now, the other thing that I like is my contacts folder, because that has names and phone numbers, and typically on my PC, I don't store phone numbers, so this is my main source for phone numbers. They are stored internally, and they don't show up just as a regular file. So what you have to do is you have to export, you have to go into the contacts app, export the contacts to a file, and it's using a card type file, a VCF, visual card file, I think it's called. But again, on my phone, it's not obvious where they store the file. So I asked Perplexity, and it told me, well, it's in the downloads folder, clearly. I mean, that's where you naturally store your file, right? So if I go to contacts and I pick up this menu here, then I can select manage contacts, export contacts to internal storage, and then it will tell me that this contacts.vcf file has been exported to internal storage somewhere, right? And it turns out it's in the downloads folder. So here we are in the downloads folder. There is the contacts.vcf file. I can transfer that over to my Android backup folder. So I've got the file there. And the easiest way, I think, to look at that thing is just by opening it in Excel. It's basically a text file. So if you try and open it in Excel and leave it as delimited, it thinks it's a delimited file. So you just say next or finish or something. And you've got all kinds of stuff here, but in Excel, you can just write a macro to get rid of all this stuff or just use a lookup. But here you can see, here's Gail, and here's our phone number, and there's Jean-Louis and his phone number. So I could write a macro to extract all that stuff pretty quickly, and I could just keep this as an archive, access it when I need to, or I could create a separate database in Excel with just the fields that I want to store. And you notice here that Jean-Louis has a photograph, and that's encoded in MIME encoded type format. Okay, I think the final thing we have before we hit the last 10 is a share from Chris.
Yeah, this is something I just came across today. Jump back. There we go. Okay, so we've had a number of presentations where we talked about stuff that Dave Plummer posts to YouTube. And he is a retired Microsoft operating system programmer, and he wrote the original Task Manager for Windows. And so he decided to rebuild it. And so he hasn't been with Microsoft for many, many years. But this is currently in beta, and there are versions available for Windows, Mac OS, and Linux. It is free, and there will be a paid version coming that is going to have some additional features built into it. None of them are currently operational. And in actual fact, there's a lot of the current stuff that will be in the free that it doesn't seem to be functioning just yet. So it is his second beta on it. And I placed it into the chat. The Shop Talk link, the first one, is the YouTube video where he talks about it and he demos it. And then the second URL, tmog.org, is where you can go to actually see some pretty screenshots and download the version you'd like to try out. So I've tried it out. It's got some interesting features from it. One of the things that was talked about earlier on was temperature or notification on your PC, and this will have temperature information that comes up in it as well as your standard task manager type stuff. So lots of pretty charts and interesting features in the program. I will report an update as soon as I get to a release version of it. He says that the free versions that you see there now, everything above what they say pro, will be available for free forever. And just the pro stuff that is below that line will be coming to a computer near you. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chris. So we're now in the last 10. Any other questions? Just one other thing I want to say about backing up Android phones. I didn't say that was one method that I use for backing up my data files. Clearly, there are lots of other things you can do. So if anybody has any other techniques which they recommend, if you want to do a share for next week or a future Q&A, Chris and I would love to hear from you, and we'll map out some time for you to do that. I see there's one question in the chat here. If you want to take your computer in for repair, how do you safeguard your personal information? And my browsers save my passwords, for example.
I was about to type in what I was thinking about that with the, I guess, interest in not actually wiping out all the personal information. What I would actually do is create another system level or administrator account on that computer and give them the password to that account. Now, it's not perfect in that they could go in and, as an administrator, change your password on your account and then log in as you and access the information that's been saved under your account. If you use a Microsoft account, they're precluded from doing that. But anytime anybody has physical access to a device, I think all security bets are potentially circumventable. But I think personally that's the thing that I would do, is just another account that is an administrator account and give them the password to that. They should be able to use that for anything they need to do to fix whatever's wrong with the computer.
Okay, could you explain that again? Set up an administrator account?
Yeah, you did create a new account on the computer. So you go into settings, accounts, and then you create a new account. And then when you create an account, after you create it, you can go to that account and you can choose to make it an administrator. It will be, by default, it will be a user account, which has limited privileges. And certainly if you send in anything for repair, they're going to want administrator.
So when they sign in, they have to have a certain password to get into.
You would give them the password for that new account that you create.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Email me if you want, and I can give you step-by-step instructions on it. And it's fairly straightforward, and it makes it a little bit more difficult for them to snoop around on the computer. Not impossible, but just they have to be much more deliberate in the fact that they're snooping.
Another thing I would note is that I don't let browsers save passwords for critical websites, like for example.
But I have so many passwords.
All right, but just
write them down. I have a whole book.
So do I, but I also have a password manager.
Yeah, password manager is a much better way of going about doing it. If you're interested, I give a presentation at the Ottawa Public Library. Usually gets picked up most seasons on keeping passwords safe, and that's specifically about using a password manager. Right now, there's been nothing scheduled for the fall, but we're expecting a schedule in the next couple of weeks.
A password manager, Chris, it's basically an encrypted database of all your website-type contacts with the user ID and the password, and it's protected by one password. So you run the program, it asks you for the master password, and then you have access to all of your other website credentials.
Okay.
There's another question here.
I've given another question. If you have a 2-hour video, what size memory stick would you recommend to save it to?
People are saying here about 1 gig per hour. Tom is saying for 2 hours, something like 8 to 12 gigabytes.
Oh, my.
But if it's a higher resolution, it might be 16 to 25 gigabytes.
Oh, my.
And if it's even bigger, it could be 32 to 64 gigabytes. So
I didn't
it
think
all depends on resolution, frame rate, and bit rate.
I didn't think they came in gigabytes. These little things?
Oh, yeah. You can't buy anything less than about a 16 gig now.
Oh.
I've got a few 4K video files that are 80 gigabytes each.
My. So the biggest that you can afford, I guess.
Well, I mean, 8 gigabytes, 6, 8, like I say, you probably can't find, well, you can find 8 gig sticks, but generally speaking, you go to Best Buy or something like that, probably everything they have on the shelf is going to be at least 16 gigabytes. You might be able to find some 8 gig ones, but usually they're at least 16.
And what's the price for an 8 gig or 16? 15.
Yeah, about two or four times what they were a couple of years ago.
What's the new price? What's the new price, Chris?
I haven't looked at them in quite a while, but...
It's not crazy, though, Diane, even probably with the new price. It wouldn't be crazy, and then it would hold more.
We want to make a bunch of gifts, and I'm going to put them
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
Christmas. You can get a 128 gig for $40.
A 128 gig, and you don't need that much.
The thing is it's...
How much is a 1 terabyte spinning hard drive, an external USB?
Now you're just going to confuse her.
Come on, you can get tons of videos on a 1 terabyte spinning disk, and you don't need
to do that. I need to give them away as gifts. I found on Amazon a pack of 3 8 gig, which I used for that, just that. I wanted to give the same thing to a bunch of people.
And B, how much were those?
I can't remember, but I'll pull it up. But it was within my budget, shall we say.
Best Buy has a 4 gig one for $6.68.
Is 4 gigabytes a lot?
No,
not enough.
No, that's not huge. I personally wouldn't go that small.
No.
But that's just to show you what the low end actually is.
Actually, I was at Computer Canada today, and I just bought 2 sticks, 64 gigs for $24. So they're basically $12 per 64 gig, and that was the smallest they had.
That's a good price.
That's not bad price though.
Yeah. You have to be careful when you buy sticks of ROM like this, or almost ROM, because there are a lot of fakes out there. Where they make one with like about 4 megabytes on it that'll pass some that look like a much larger drive but have nothing on it.
I used to go to Staples. They're pretty.
Amazon is and I guess eBay are probably the worst for this. But of course, you can always get refunds. But you have to be careful. I've been fairly lucky, but I've had some duds that were fake, and I had to get refunds.
You can always start at Walmart. They usually have pretty good prices.
And they're reliable? Like, they're not junk?
No, they're good.
They'd be fine. Walmart, you can only take it back if it doesn't work.
The USB stick, whatever it says, that will be what it is. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And there's a good tip here from Tristan. He says, if you have the video file, right-click on it and select Properties, and that will show you the size.
Okay.
And I highly recommend that no matter what the source is, when you get it home, test that it is actually not a fake drive, and I pasted it into the chat. Test all new flash drives with a utility made by Steve Gibson at Gibson Research called ValiDrive, and it will validate that it is not a fake drive, fake flash drive. Mm-hmm. And so I recommend that you do that no matter what the source is. It runs very quickly.
In the chat. What are you saying to use?
I put it into the chat. So if you click on the chat in here, it'll be test all flash drives, and it has the URL to Steve Gibson's website.
Oh, I see. That program.
So I highly recommend that people do that on all new flash drives that they buy.
Okay. All right.
My 3 USB 8 gigabyte drives is $17.59 from Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah. So they are really cheap. I mean, okay.
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah.
Just I have to make about 5 of them.
Actually, when I did a wedding video a couple of weeks back, but an hour and 20 minutes after I converted it into an MP4 file, it was actually 6.54 gigs.
Okay.
Now, this is a question for everybody else. After I had that, I tried to copy it to a flash drive that's supposed to have 8 gigs available, and they kept telling me that it was the file was too big for the stick. So even when I tried converting 6.54 gigs with like 1024 × 1024 × 1024 × 6.54, it came out like to 7.0 something.
Yeah, because you probably had it formatted in FAT32. You'd have to format it to a file system that supports files bigger than 4 gigs.
That 32 will support bigger than that. It's a, if it's a FAT16, and it tops out at 4 gig file max. But if you're FAT32 or NTFS, you get well beyond that limit.
Okay. Follow-up question on that. So with this video, I said, okay, well, if it was a little bit too big, so I had a little bit of dead space in the video, so I said, okay, I'll try and edit it. I did use Clipchamp to cut out about 6 minutes worth of video, but when I went to save it, it went from 6 gigs to 12.8 gigs. I'm wondering, is that normal?
That little bit of quality settings in your save, I mean.
Yeah, probably the bit rate was set really high.
No, I had it at 1080p from the original, because like when I went to when I played the MP4, it had the bigger screen, and then
That's the resolution. That's not the bit rate. There's like a quality setting, which is the bit rate. But I think you're further ahead, just to make sure you format it as either FAT32 or NTFS. And then you should be able to save the full 6 gig file to it, no problem.
I have one other little question. So if you're putting, if you have two USB ports on your computer, could you download a video onto both at the same time?
In theory, yeah, you can be copying to multiple devices at the same time, but they may be on the same channel, so... I don't think you're really going to gain an awful lot by trying to do two at the same time.
All right. I got a lot of work ahead of me.
Also, there's for video, there's two different compression regimens, H.264 and H.265. And H.265 is harder to edit, but it takes less space, while H.264 is easier to edit. But takes more space. So that's also something you have to choose when you save a video.
Well, this was done through OBS, so it had MKV, I think it is, which is its raw format, and then I just had to remux it to MP4, and it gave it a 6.54 gig, so I thought it was actually pretty good.
I think MP4 and MKV are both kind of holders,
they're both containers
rather than compression.
I tried even tried zipping it. It went from 6.54 to 6.48. It's like, well, that wasn't really much of a compression.
They're generally not compressible through a zip format.
Okay, well, there you go. That explains that part.
Okay, good discussion, everybody. That was the last 15 to 20, I think. Anyway, lots of interesting information. The contents of the chat window will be on the website later on tonight. In the meantime, you saw that we had a few suggestions for YouTube videos, technical type things. So if you have a favorite video or a channel that you'd like to recommend, we're always open to that for our YouTube tech series. If you need to know some things about computer applications or operating systems, send us a question. We'll try and find an answer. And if Harvey's still around, he's going to tell us about the other problem.
There we go. Just before the meeting, I sent out another email to the members as a reminder. So, yes, October 21st, mark your calendars. We're going to have a get-together of the members at Olive Garden at Hampton Park. They have a great menu, and you'll just love it. So put it on your calendar. Looking forward to see you. Send me an email at olivegarden@opcug.ca, and I'll make sure you're going to be reserved with the other bunch. Thanks.
Harvey.
Thanks, Harvey. And if people need the information on that, it's in the current newsletter.
Hi, Harvey.
Yeah.
Last night, my wife took my sister to Olive Garden. They waited 2 hours.
Well, we have they're going to get a reservation. Right now, they're not accepting reservations. So hopefully by October, we'll be able to get in there. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that.
That's right. But they're not accepting reservations, so they're all up in the air.
Okay.
Yeah.
They may take a reservation for like 20 or 30 people who are coming because obviously they need to change the setup of their chairs and tables for that. And come as you can, first come, first serve. It's not appropriate. It doesn't work for them.
No, I have to get them to give us a time and what's appropriate, so that'll work out well. Yeah.
Just make sure to tell them how many.
That's what we do.
That's why you need to register. Okay, thanks, everyone. And coming so up. Next week will be our next Q&A, Wednesday, September the 2nd. So if you have questions, if you want to provide some follow-up on things we've talked about tonight, if you've got new topics that you'd like to share, as always, send us a few details to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll be happy to see you all next Wednesday. Hope everybody enjoyed tonight, and that's it for me.